on radio, online and mobile. You're with SBS Radio.
Good evening and welcome to SBS World News Radio. I'm Peggy Giacomelos.
And I'm Janice Peterson. Coming up, the Prime Minister arrives in Vietnam for the APEC Summit.
Also on the program...
That's said to Australia, you must do better. This is an extraordinary thing for a country with all the wealth and prosperity that we have.
Australia condemned by the UN for its failure to respond appropriately to UN humanitarian guidance.
And...
The announcement is absolutely awesome. It just takes the community languages education to an absolutely different level.
New South Wales makes a multi-million dollar investment in community language classes.
Those stories and more coming up in the next half hour.
Good evening. With the news at 6 o'clock, I'm Janice Peterson. The High Court will determine whether New South Wales Liberal Holly Hughes is eligible to replace former Deputy Nationals leader Fiona Nash. There are concerns Ms Hughes could be in breach of Section 44 of the Constitution, which bans people from holding parliamentary office if they've held an office of profit under the Crown. Ms Hughes was appointed to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, after losing the 2016 election and the Senate recount. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says the Section 44 provisions are having quite an impact.
It's certainly becoming a matter of great concentration, but that's been referred to the full bench and that's, you know, I'll leave it to the court to determine. Once again, they're the only ones that can make these determinations.
Footage released by the lobby group GetUp has revealed the squalid conditions inside the former Manus Island Processing Centre. Hundreds of men are refusing to leave the now closed facility and have been left without washing facilities and no electricity. Shen Nasiria Nasami from GetUp, who visited Manus, says the situation has reached crisis point.
We saw a humanitarian catastrophe, a situation in which people are going to die or be seriously ill within days. It was horrific, oppressively hot. People were in shipping containers. There was sewage overflowing in the camps. There was no water. There was no lights. There was no food. People looked lethargic. People were without medication who have ongoing chronic illnesses.
The Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton, has told Radio 3AW the images released by GetUp don't reveal the complete picture.
People have... done a great deal of damage, it seems to me, by some of the photos. They've trashed the accommodation and, as was pointed out, there's new accommodation, purpose-built. It's been open for a couple of years. People have known for months that this end date was coming up, and really the conditions that we see in the photographs today don't resemble at all the conditions in which people have been living over a long period of time.
A man responsible for a fatal one-punch attack on a footballer will spend at least 5 years in jail. 34-year-old Andrew William Lee pleaded guilty to manslaughter after prosecutors agreed to drop a murder charge. Lee struck 19-year-old Patrick Cronin during a brawl outside a Melbourne hotel in April last year. The judge imposed an 8-year jail term, saying Lee had shown remorse and had good prospects for rehabilitation. Outside the court, the victim's parents, Matt and Robin Cronin, called for tougher laws for one-punch attacks.
The legislation, as the judge said today, it's ambiguous. The cases that it will apply in are so limited.
Our most basic understanding is that, and I'm not a lawyer, manslaughter is murder without intent. And then to be sentenced under the coward punch, intent suddenly brought back.
Yeah.
So... How can it ever be used in that fashion? It has to change.
Yep.
It has to change.
The New South Wales government has announced it's putting $7.6 million into creating a new community language institute at the University of Sydney. The New South Wales Minister for Multiculturalism, Ray Williams, told SBS Arabic 24 the new facility will support 54 languages.
Thousands and thousands of children will now benefit in the future through an embrace of a second language. That is not only connecting them with their cultural heritage, but allowing them to speak in the future in a more global context. And that is going to be a huge benefit to not only our cultural diversity in New South Wales, but to New South Wales economically and socially, and more importantly for Australia.
Britain's Prince Charles has praised India's commitment to renewable energy and urged other countries to follow its lead. India aims to generate 175 gigawatts of electricity through renewables by 2022 and boost natural gas to 15% of its energy needs as part of a plan to use cleaner fuels for power plants and transport. In sports, Socceroos coach Ange Postecoglou says he's not impressed by the quality of the playing surface for tomorrow's World Cup qualifying match against Honduras. Postecoglou inspected the pitch ahead of Australia's final training session.
Obviously, I just had a bit of a walk on it now. Look, the pitch is not in great condition. It's obviously a little bit bumpy and a little bit soft. But we were prepared for that, and we understand, it's going to be hard to play the kind of football we want to play. But, we will adjust to that. And the players will have a run today, have a look at it, and, we'll adjust accordingly tomorrow.
Now, look at tomorrow's weather. Perth, a possible late storm, 36. Adelaide, cloudy and 33. Becoming sunny in Melbourne, a top of 26. Hobart, partly cloudy, 21. Showers developing and 24 the top for Canberra. Wollongong and Newcastle, partly cloudy, 21. For Sydney, grey skies, 23. Brisbane, a shower or two and 24. And for Darwin, a shower or two and possible showers as well, 33 degrees. Peggy, more on those stories coming up on SBS World News at 6:30.
Thanks, Janice. Janice Peterson there. And across Australia, you're listening to SBS World News Radio. Peggy Giacomelos with you. The time is 6 past the hour. The Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says regional partnerships are vital to Australia's enduring success in maintaining peace and stability in the region. The Prime Minister is in Vietnam to attend the APEC meeting in the coastal city of Da Nang. SBS Chief Political Correspondent Daniela Ritorto is in Vietnam with the PM.
Malcolm Turnbull, one of the first official bilateral meetings he's had of APEC, is with the host, the Prime Minister of Vietnam. And very much that the Prime Minister is trying to stress this idea that while there's a lot of talk about a return to protectionism, especially with the attitude of the US now under Donald Trump, that in Asia in particular, Australia has so much to gain from these rapidly developing markets in Southeast Asia, and Vietnam is very much one of them. They also talked a bit of security, and there's some sort of feeling perhaps that if Australia pushes too hard with countries like, gets too close, say, with countries in the region, will China feel, left out? But the Prime Minister says that Australia wants to keep a nice balance of peace and stability in the region, saying that that's the foundation for the extraordinary rise of prosperity that we've seen throughout much of Asia of the last decades or so.
And Daniela, Mr. Turnbull is an unapologetic cheerleader for trade. What's next on the agenda for him and the other leaders at APEC?
Peggy, very much trying to negotiate something called TPP-11. If you remember, this time last year, once Mr. Trump was elected, won the US election, one of the first things he promised to do was to rip up the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a 12-country Pacific Rim trading bloc that he described as a disaster for blue-collar American workers. And when President Trump did that, many people thought, well, the TPP is dead. But quietly, Australia, Japan and a few others have been trying to revive it and make it work, even without the giant economy of the US. They're pointing to figures showing there would only be a slight, tiny sort of percentage point of benefit with or without the US. So they're trying to negotiate that today. There's a lot of talk of optimism, but it is going down to the wire, we understand. They're also trying to negotiate it in a way that perhaps post-Trump or post the Trump era, America could one day rejoin it. So a few misunderstandings we understand around the place, especially between some of the countries. We understand that Japan said a deal was pretty much reached in agreement. Canada said, oh, it's not a done deal yet. So very much, as I said, negotiations going down to the wire on that. But if they do pull that off, that'll be a huge achievement of this APEC here in Vietnam.
That's SBS Chief Political Correspondent Daniela Ritorto on the line from the APEC Summit in Vietnam. Thanks for joining us this evening. The time is 10 past the hour. Australia has been condemned by the United Nations for its failure to respond appropriately to UN humanitarian guidance. A report by its Human Rights Committee has criticised Australia's human rights record on a range of issues, including its treatment of refugees, Indigenous rights and a lack of protection of human rights. It comes a month after Australia was elected unopposed to the United Nations Human Rights Council. Maya Jamison reports.
Australia needs to bring its protection of human rights up to international standards. That's the finding from the UN Human Rights Committee in its latest report on Australia's human rights record. The committee, made up of 18 independent experts, harshly criticises Australia for its failure to comply with a key human rights treaty. Vice Chairman of the committee, Yuval Shani, says it's time Australia adopted international standards.
The standard that we are setting, we think, is a standard which is quite minimalistic, and that we expect most countries in the world, certainly countries that assume a leadership position in the world of human rights, such as Australia, that was just elected to the Human Rights Council, to embrace these standards.
The committee's report comes nearly 2 weeks after the closure of the Manus Island Detention Centre, where some 600 men are refusing to leave, saying they fear for their safety. As their protests continue, smuggled video footage from activist group GetUp has revealed the conditions the men are living in, without water and electricity, in temperatures of up to 40 degrees. Shen Narayanasamy is the human rights co-director of the group and has just returned from Manus. Speaking to SBS, she says the situation has reached crisis point.
They said they feared for their lives outside. They feared for their lives inside as well, but what they faced in reality was a slow death inside the camp or potentially a rapid one outside.
The federal government has long faced criticism of its border policies, as well as keeping asylum seekers and refugees in poorly maintained offshore processing centres. Yuval Shani says Australia cannot treat asylum seekers as criminals and absolve itself of its duty.
We call on Australia to, in paragraph 36 of the report, to end its offshore transfer arrangements to arrange following the closure of these processing centres, to ensure that the individuals held there are transferred to Australia or relocated to other appropriate safe country, and to monitor the situation after closure of the centre.
As protests continue across Australia, Defence Industry Minister Christopher Pyne told the Nine Network activists are doing more harm than good.
Those people who are still in the Manus Island Detention Centre have chosen not to take the options that the government has made available to them, and that is because many of them are being told by Australian activists to stay in Manus Island and they'll get them to Australia. The message from the government's very clear. Anyone who's come via people smugglers will not end up in Australia.
The report by the UN also condemned the over-representation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in prisons. Indigenous Australians are the most incarcerated people in the world. It also denounced the age of criminal responsibility in some states and territories, as young as 10 years old. Executive Director of Australia's Human Rights Law Centre, Hugh de Kretser, has told SBS the report is damning.
That's said to Australia, you must do better. This is an extraordinary thing for a country with all the wealth and prosperity that we have to be locking people at such unprecedented rates on a global scale. The UN has highlighted that as one of the issues that Australia must address to fix our human rights record.
Hugh de Kretser, ending that report by Maya Jamison. It's 14 past the hour. Don't forget you can download our stories online anytime, sbs.com.au/news/audio. As Australians prepare to commemorate Remembrance Day tomorrow, an Australian First World War historian says Remembrance Day has been almost completely eclipsed by Anzac Day in Australia's consciousness. But the Australian War Memorial maintains there's room for 2 days that remember soldiers' sacrifices. Greg Dyett reports.
Every year, at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, Australians pause to remember fallen soldiers. As RSL National President Robert Dick explains, Remembrance Day marks the moment hostilities ceased on the Western Front of the First World War in 1918, after 4 years of hostilities.
It's very significant in that it ceased hostilities in what was a very brutal industrial war, which was claiming many lives of soldiers and civilians alike.
But some believe its significance has lessened as Australians' focus has shifted to Anzac Day commemorations. Professor Robin Pryor is the author of 6 books about the First World War and is a visiting professorial fellow at the University of Adelaide.
We do so much for Anzac Day on the 25th of April, which countries like Britain don't. Their main day is the 11th. Of November, the day the war ended on the Western Front. We get, as it were, a double dose because of Anzac Day.
So has Anzac Day superseded Remembrance Day?
Look, I'd say not completely, but to a large extent, yes. Anzac Day is the day that we commemorate people who went to war.
Chris Weidenbach from the Australian War Memorial says the 2 days are significant for different reasons.
I don't think that Remembrance Day is any less significant. It's simply that Anzac Day has a different purpose. Anzac Day is a day for commemoration, for thanking the veterans, and it's also part of our national story. Remembrance Day, on the other hand, is solely about remembrance. It's solely about remembering those 102,800 Australians who have given their lives for us.
Robert Dick believes Remembrance Day doesn't share the same status in Australia as it does overseas, and he's calling on the government to place more importance on it.
Unfortunately, I think here in Australia it has lost a little bit of significance, and it would be very, very good if the Australian government would turn around and declare that at 11 o'clock on the 11th day of the 11th month, you know, everything stops for 1 minute, just 1 minute silence. That's all we're asking, to remember all those that have, you know, suffered in times of warfare.
More than 70 million people fought in World War One, with estimates of the dead between 9 and 13 million, many of who have no known grave. Professor Pryor says there are a few lessons to be learnt from the Great War that are still relevant to today's high-tech, low-troop deployment warfare. He says a war fought as it was in 1914-18 would never happen today.
For a start, the public wouldn't cope at all, nor should they, with the casualties that were inflicted in the First World War. Imagine 60,000 casualties on the first day of the Battle of the Somme.
For veteran Robert Dick, while the methods of war have changed, the fundamental lessons from the First Industrial War still haven't been learnt.
We have troops deployed in many locations around the world at the present moment, and you now have the War on Terror. Human nature has to change to start overcoming that. You know, we have to learn to negotiate before we, you know, pick up weapons and go to war with each other.
That's veteran Robert Dick ending that story, which was produced by Rosemary Bolger. We'll have some more news after this break.
Sarah View comes from a farming tradition, but he's a renegade at heart, playing with planting conditions and varieties to create vegetables with the most interesting characteristics.
SBS Food serves up the best cuisine from around the globe. Thursday nights on SBS.
Hi, I'm Jenny Brockie. Tonight on Insight.
Insight on SBS is Australia's leading forum for public debate.
The best stories are real and often deeply personal.
Join Jenny Brockie as she draws incredible personal stories from remarkable Australians and drives debate on diverse issues.
These are important stories from brave people that take courage to tell. Welcome everyone, good to have you here tonight. Tanya, your late father, Boyan, had one of Queensland's biggest property empires. He left you nothing. Correct. Why?
Insight, Tuesdays, 8:30 on SBS and on demand.
Start with a pinch of this, add a little bit of that, and you have all the ingredients for the perfect recipe. Check out Food Network, Australia's new food channel.
Absolutely delicious.
Serving up 24/7 food free on Channel 33.
Watch the Premier League on SBS, the biggest names and teams in football, live, free and in HD.
Face to face with Zabaleta. Rose with the cross. Oh. And smashed it with own goal by Carlos.
Saturday nights on SBS.
SBS World News brings you the global and national news that matters. Hear the latest news on radio, Monday to Friday at 6 p.m. And watch our TV bulletin on SBS Daily at 6:30 p.m. Find out more at sbs.com.au/news.
This is SBS World News Radio with Peggy Chuck-Melos. Coming up, a look ahead at the weekend in sport, including the first leg of the World Cup qualifier between Australia and Honduras. That story in a couple of minutes' time. But before that, one of Australia's most multicultural states has made a multi-million dollar investment in community language classes. 34,000 students across New South Wales study a second language out of school hours. They're taught by over 2,500 teachers. And as Omar Dabaj reports, the state's premier has promised they'll all be given greater support.
The New South Wales government has invested in a $7.5 million deal with the University of Sydney to establish a research institute for community language education. It is part of an $11 million pledge towards community language schools that was announced in May. Premier Gladys Berejiklian, who attended an Armenian language school as a child, hopes it will increase opportunities for the students in later life.
The benefits of learning a second language or learning the language of your parents is a fantastic opportunity for all children. And I'm really looking forward to expanding that opportunity, but also giving it professional oversight. To have Sydney University provide teachers and principals with the tools they need, it's wonderful to think that students will be gaining some kind of credit for the language studies they're doing, whether it's through the HSC or whether it's just to be able to say that they did it through the auspices of Sydney University.
The Research Institute has been named the Sydney Institute for Community Languages Education. Ken Cruikshank from the University of Sydney School of Education says it will have a number of priorities.
We're interested in three basic initiatives. The first one, we're going to find out from the schools what they're doing, how they're teaching, what their needs are, and we can get an idea of what to do then. We're going to develop syllabuses with the Department of Education for the schools that haven't got them. We're going to develop resources, both online and hard copy, to support the teachers.
There is also a long-term goal for teachers to gain a pathway to accreditation. Michael Christodoulou, president of the state's Community Languages School Federation, says it could come via either a bachelor's or master's degree.
A lot of our teachers are overseas trained teachers, and unfortunately they needed to be upskilled within the Australian education system, so therefore most of the funding will go towards that. There is economic benefits for New South Wales and indeed Australia, because children learning languages later on in their life, in their careers, they'll be able to use their language and, of course, economic benefits.
260 languages are spoken across New South Wales, with 58 taught in community classes. That includes the Feng Hua Chinese School, with 4 campuses across Sydney and 1,000 students. Caroline Yi Shu, who has been the principal at the school for 19 years, says the development is a significant one.
I think this is a great decision to make, because the students in community language school can be the great culture bridge for Australia, between Australia and other countries. And so this is a really great job for the community language school.
Mila Krivoznia from Western Sydney St. Alexander Nevsky Russian School agrees.
The announcement is absolutely awesome. It just takes the community languages education to an absolutely different level. Extra resources in general, yes, and just taking the education to a further level where they can get this to HSC and universities.
Only 7.5% of students study language for the HSC in New South Wales. That's less than a third of the numbers in Victoria, and even less study language at university. Mr. Cruikshank says the announcement aims to change that.
What happens at the moment, we know that 20% of kids in New South Wales go to school bilingual. they bring two languages into the school. But often by the time they get to year 12, they're monolingual in English. And this is such a wastage of resources. A lot of people say it's just for jobs, career, travel. But in actual fact, we know now from the research that languages increase cognitive skills.
Thanks to Omar Dabaj for that report. It's 24 past the hour. We'll have the latest news headlines and Saturday's weather coming up in a couple of minutes' time. But before that, to sport, and the first leg of the World Cup qualifier between Australia and Honduras is the biggest talking point for most sporting fans this weekend. But there's also a Wallabies clash in Cardiff and the historic Pink Ball Ashes cricket test between Australia and England's women's teams will go a long way to deciding their series. John Baldock takes a look ahead.
Australia and Honduras will both be desperate to make a good start to their playoff when the countries meet in San Pedro Sula on Saturday morning. The winner will advance to next year's FIFA World Cup in Russia. Most of the build-up has focused on the future of Ange Postecoglou. After his refusal to confirm or deny speculation, he'll be standing down as Socceroos coach. There's also been speculation about leading scorer Tim Cahill's fitness. He injured his ankle in last weekend's A-League match for Melbourne City against Sydney FC. But thankfully for Australia fans, Cahill was deemed fit enough to make the long journey to Central America. Midfielder James Jago says having him there to help guide the team is a massive plus, even if he plays no part in the first leg clash.
You understand straight away why there's such a rush to get him back in, because just around the hotel and training his presence, and you can see the boys sort of look to him to drag him along, and you know that's why having him here is so important.
The return leg takes place in Sydney on Wednesday evening. And it's not just Honduras and Australia facing crucial World Cup playoffs over the weekend. South Africa and Senegal go head-to-head, and Algeria takes on Nigeria, as those nations aim to qualify out of Africa. In Europe, Sweden and Italy face off, with the Azzurri hoping to avoid missing out on a World Cup for the first time since 1958. Elsewhere, New Zealand and Peru will battle it out in the first leg of their playoff. On the local football scene, SBS Viceland has live coverage of the W League on Sunday afternoon, when title favourites the Melbourne City travel to Newcastle to play the Jets. That match gets underway from 4 p.m. In the early hours of Sunday morning, the Wallabies play Wales in Cardiff on the second match of their Rugby Union Spring Tour, a match that SBS has live coverage of from 4 a.m. The previous 12 matches have all gone the way of Australia, with the last Welsh victory coming way back in 2008. Australia's new Fijian-born centre pairing of Tevita Kuridrani and Samu Karevi are hoping to continue their stunning form since reuniting in the team. They scored 5 tries between them in last weekend's win against Japan, which kicked off the spring tour. Kuridrani edged out his close friend, scoring 3 tries, and he's hoping the understanding they've built up over many years of friendship will continue in Cardiff against Wales.
I think last time we played with each other was last year, the June series, where he made his debut. And to see how he has developed into an international player, it's very great to play alongside him. Hopefully I can get more games together and get the combination.
The Women's Ashes could be decided over the weekend as Australia and England do battle at North Sydney Oval in the historic clash. The 4-day match will conclude on Sunday evening under floodlights, with both sides hoping to master the pink ball used in day-night matches to good effect. All-rounder Elise Perry is one of Australia's leading players, and she says having established a 4-2 lead on points after the one-day portion of the series, the team knows exactly what's at stake.
Every game's kind of important, as I said, because you know, you're playing for points each match, and yeah, I think we had a really good one-day series and it was great to kind of get the upper hand there by a couple of points, but if we win this, then we retain the Ashes, so I think everyone's really aware of that and keen to play well.
On Sunday afternoon, just after 4 p.m. in Adelaide, Australia and Ireland goes into the opening international rules match. The hybrid sport combines parts of AFL and Gaelic football and has grown in popularity since it was first played back in 1984. In other sports action over the weekend, SBS Viceland has live coverage of the Sydney Kings National Basketball League trip to Melbourne United on Saturday afternoon. That match gets underway at 5:30 p.m. Then on Sunday at 3 p.m, SBS will have the All-Queensland affair between the Brisbane Bullets and the Cairns Taipans.
Thanks to John Baldock there. Let's take a quick look at what's making news before we go. And the Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton, says the images released from Manus Island by the lobby group GetUp don't tell the full story. Mr Dutton says there's new purpose-built accommodation available to the men, and the photographs released today don't resemble the conditions the men are living in. The UN Human Rights Committee has called on Australia to stop rejecting refugees and change its migration laws in line with international standards. The committee also raised concerns about conditions on Manus Island and Nauru. And a man responsible for a fatal one-punch attack on a footballer will spend at least 5 years in jail. Andrew William Lee pleaded guilty to manslaughter after prosecutors agreed to drop a murder charge. And finally, Socceroos coach Ange Postecoglou says he's not impressed by the quality of the playing surface for tomorrow's World Cup qualifying match against Honduras. Postecoglou inspected the pitch ahead of Australia's final training session. Now a look at Saturday's weather. A possible late storm for Perth and a top of 36 degrees, cloudy in Adelaide and 33. In Melbourne, becoming sunny in 26. In Hobart, partly cloudy in 21. In Canberra, a shower or two developing, a top of 24. In Wollongong and Newcastle, partly cloudy in 21 degrees. Similar conditions for Sydney in 23. In Brisbane, a shower or two in 24. Cairns, a shower or two in 29. And in Darwin, a shower or two with a possible storm, a top of 33 degrees. That's the program for this evening. Don't forget you can download our features anytime at sbs.com.au/news/audio. I'm Peggy Giacomelos. Thanks for listening.